Rainwater harvesting is truly about turning water scarcity into abundance, generating more resources and life. Today, we are talking to the expert, and those of you who have listened to me for any amount of shows know when I say the expert, I mean it, on rainwater harvesting, Brad Lancaster, specifically discussing the revised, full-color, over-the-top, amazing, best-selling, award-winning guide, Rainwater Harvesting for Dryland and Beyond. And there are numerous editions. We're going to get into all those details. So welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth Water. Brad, it is so great to have you back on our show after way too long. I had to look it up, and I don't know if you know, it was 10 years ago.
Wow, time flies.
And boy, talk about, I was such a rookie, and I'm not anymore. And I know now that our most precious resource is water. On every plane that you talk about, it is, we have lots of ground to cover. But before we jump in, I would just like to share a bit more with our listeners about what you've accomplished, because it really matters. So Brad is the author of the award-winning Rainwater Harvesting for Drylands and Beyond and co-founder of DesertHarvesters.org. Since 1993, Brad has run a successful permaculture education, design, and consultation business focused on integrative, regenerative approaches to landscape design, planning, and living. And there's so much more in that story that I know, and hopefully we can cover some of it, but in the Sonoran Desert, with just 11 inches of annual rainfall, he and his brother harvest about 100,000 gallons of rainwater a year on, ready? We should do a drum roll here, Brad, an eighth acre urban lot and adjoining right-of-way. And people in Tucson take guests down there and say, that's Brad Lancaster's house. That's where he lives. I'm one of those people. The harvested water is then turned into living air conditioners of food-bearing shade trees, abundant gardens, and the thriving landscape incorporating wildlife habitat, beauty, medicinal plants, and more. The goal of his book series and overall work is to empower his clients and community to make positive change in their own lives and neighborhoods by harvesting and enhancing free on-site resources such as water, sun, wind, shade, community, and more. And it's working, as evidenced by the tens of thousands of practitioners and demand for Brad's work around the world. And Brad, you can tell I read a lot of that, but to get all the content in, it's got to be read so people know what your journey has been and your brother's journey and the difference you've made for the planet. So thanks for being here.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
You know, I thought about this, and really the best place to start, even though I have many questions, is tell everybody what rainwater harvesting is, because believe it or not, new listeners or people that are not on the rainwater harvesting website might not know exactly what it is. So why don't we start there with your explanation of what is rainwater harvesting?
Sure. So rainwater harvesting is the capture and use of the rain falling from the sky in a way that makes it much more abundant longer into the dry seasons, and also helps mitigate flooding in the wet seasons. There's two primary ways one can harvest water. The easiest, most accessible way is with rain gardens, or these passive water harvesting earthworks. So they're basically these bowl-like shapes in the landscape that collect and concentrate water. And then we plant within or beside these bowl-like shapes. But the idea is not to create puddles or surface water. The idea is to create a living sponge of mulch, rich soil life, and vegetation that will very rapidly absorb that water. So it's actually stored subsurface, so we don't lose it to evaporation and we don't breed mosquitoes. And then when we want to access the water, we do so in the form of living pumps, such as the vegetation. So we can enjoy that water in the form of fruit, food, medicinals, shelter, cooling, wildlife habitat, beauty, and much more. Another way of harvesting rainwater is with active strategies. And when I say active, I mean some person has to turn off a valve for it to work, because you're usually storing water in a tank, and then you have to turn the valve on or off to let the water out. Whereas the rain garden, or the passive earthwork I mentioned before, no one has to be around. It just works once it's installed. So tanks, they're a great strategy to hold water and to have it available when you want it. But you have to buy the tank, and you have to maintain the tank. There's great potential there. So I live in a small, tiny house. I share a property with my brother. He's in a small house, he and his family. But in my tiny house, I only have 400 square feet of roof. And yet that's more than enough roof area to provide all my domestic water needs for a year. So that's all drinking, bathing, cooking, washing, irrigating the plants, everything. But that just having a 400 square foot roof on its own wouldn't be sufficient. I've integrated multiple harvests. I reuse my water multiple times with gray water harvesting and other strategies. I minimize my need for water and energy for cooling by growing living air conditioners. But we can talk about all that later.
Water is mostly washing machine and showers and faucet, right?
Yeah, so that's
those are the three biggies.
It's the lightly used household water.
Right.
So it's everything that goes down the drain except your toilet.
Right.
That's black water. And depending on who's looking at it, kitchen sink water. So I like to consider kitchen sink water dark gray water, whereas some states consider that black water. So you manage it a little bit differently than you would gray water from a shower, bathtub, or washing machine.
Okay. And I learned so much about this since you and I last spoke, and we changed every single product we have in our house to be earth friendly, non-toxic, doesn't contaminate the water. And those things that's like a story for another day. So when you talk about your property, 100,000 gallons of water a year, mm-hmm. What is the potential for water harvesting? We live in the flipping desert, and we are going to have more hot days than we have ever seen. Every summer, you and I know it's going to get hotter. And when we have monsoons, you know, I've heard Joaquin Murrieta Salvador make this presentation about if we could just really stop all the monsoon water and get it in the earth, the sacred Santa Cruz would start flowing again. So what's the potential? I'm sure you know the answer to that question for water harvesting.
Yeah. Well, here's a little statistic, I think, that kind of sums it up. So in our desert community of Tucson, more rain falls on the surface area of Tucson in an average year of rainfall than the entire population of over 500,000 people consumes of municipal water in a year. So there's actually more rain falling on Tucson than all Tucsonans consume of water. So we have all that we need and more. The key is we just have to change our management of that water.
Yeah.
Because at the moment, the vast majority of people send that water immediately to the storm drain. So we lose the water to runoff and evaporation. So I'm advocating that we turn drainage into infiltration. So instead of throwing the water away, we reinvest it as close as possible to where it falls. So instead of being dependent in our landscapes, for example, on imported drinking water to irrigate our landscapes, we can just use free rainfall falling on our site.
Yeah.
And the key is to hold on to it. Don't just get rid of it.
Right. And it comes down ferociously. That's the word I like to use. And when it goes into the storm water, it's contaminated, therefore unusable, because all the grease from our roads and all the other debris and all that. So once you don't capture it, it's gone. Even though I think they're going to figure out how to catch it all and use it, because it's going to demand, the climate's going to demand it. So I know there are degrees of this, but if you're talking about like the first part that you discussed, where you just create your yard with berms and the right kind of holes and all of this stuff to capture the water, that to me is what I would call free, because all it takes is a shovel and information. But what are we talking about in terms of costs for water harvesting if you have a rainwater harvesting, you know, a big, container? What are the kinds of costs?
Well, that's all going to depend. It's going to depend on your lifestyle, the size of your home, your water needs, all of that. So, I have, for my house, 2 1,000-gallon tanks. So they cost, they're about $1,000 a piece, for those tanks. So there's $2,000 investment there. And then I need a little bit of plumbing to connect it to the gutter, send the water from the roof to the gutter, to the tank, and then from the tank to my sink. Let's say $3,000 in materials, but now I've got water for life. And if the water grid goes down, I'm totally set. I still have water. I have higher quality water than the city provides. And it's chlorine free. It's salt free. It has natural nutrients. And I just love that connection. Where I know exactly where my water is coming from, and I know exactly where it goes after I've used it, because I cycle it through myriad reuses on site, mimicking the planetary hydrologic cycle, but doing it on a very local context.
And it looks like that movie Little Shop of Horrors, it just looks like your property is, you just want to go in there and stay. Because you know it's going to be greener, cooler, fresher, nicer. So the costs really vary. There's a range, and you are talking about, free. Some of the stuff you can do for free and harvest it besides rainwater. So we covered that. And then I want to get into the books, because it kind of cracked me up. I read all the materials you supplied to us, which I should. I owe that to the guest. But I was thinking about, I wrote a book. Your mother called Mother Earth, You Better Call Her Back. And the reason I wrote a book is because people said, in what I do, it gives you credibility. Well, you already had credibility. So I want to know why you wrote the first edition of Rainwater Harvesting for Dry Lands, Volume 1, in the first place. What inspired you? Because writing a book is hard. I know it. Oh, and yeah. I have to write another book, but it's really hard. And then yours went on to national bestselling, and you sold thousands and thousands of copies. So what inspired you to do Volume 1?
I couldn't find the book, the resource that I needed. So I decided to create it. When I was doing research, I had stacks and stacks of books and articles and website links just throughout my house. And each had pieces of the puzzle, but I couldn't find anything that integrated it all into a very digestible, usable whole and very accessible whole. So out of frustration, I created what I couldn't find and what I was looking for. And the great thing about this whole journey of doing multiple editions and revisions is, the first edition was great, but as Ira Glass, who is the producer and creator of This American Life,
right?
I'm going to kind of butcher his quote, but he has something like, we all get these killer visions that are just amazing, and we go for it. But when we first start, we don't reach that level of our vision. The vision is still killer. It's still awesome.
Right.
But we don't yet have the ability or the experience to bring our initial creation to that killer level. And So that's what's been so great about doing multiple editions and reworking it every time I reprint. I've finally gotten to the place that not only have I reached that original killer vision, but I've actually far exceeded it. So I'm super happy.
And what I love about this on so many levels, first to have you back, second to know what you've done in terms of impacting the planet. And then the other part of it is when I looked at my book that I wrote, I almost like freaked because I know so much more now than I did when I wrote it. It's like, I want to redo it, revise it, and get it up. I want to change the name of it somewhat and make it shorter. But I understand because you're on a lifelong journey of learning. And this is totally not off topic, but it's not in any of the things that we said we were going to talk about. You know, I'm kind of obsessed with, and I don't worry, I never play Stump the Guest, but I'm kind of obsessed with you know, the 17 sustainable development goals for UNESCO, and which to me, there's a lot to that story that's not all great. But they have this initiative to plant a billion trees. And I've read a lot about it in Africa, countries where blah, 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 blah. And some of it's failing miserably. And I think about what you would do as an advisor to UNESCO, saying you don't just plant trees, folks. They're giving money to African governments, some of which are corrupt, some of which aren't. It might have to go through 11 different departments. And they're spending, I think it's over $1 billion to plant these trees. And lo and behold, they're dying. However, there's a bigger and bigger swath of land where they're not, because they're talking to the farmers that live there about what it's going to take for these trees to succeed. And to me, that's what inspires me about your work. You don't just catch the water. There has to be some effort and some learning and some reading, and it's worth it because, you know, I say this now a lot, the life you save may be your own, because it's the predictions for rainwater for, you know, our Southwest in particular are not. So in the inspiration for the book, is there anybody you feel like you giving a shout out to? You know, we could make this a 2-hour podcast, but I love it if there's anybody like that were influencers for you. It's always nice to give them a shout out because I know that you were inspired by a class at the U of A. Oh, we're supposed to call it UA, but I'm never going to do that, University of Arizona. So I just, people made an imprint along your journey, and maybe we can leave it at that. It's your call.
Yeah, two people come immediately to mind. And the first one is African subsistence farmer, Mr. Zephaniah Piri Maseko. So I visited him back in 1995, and he was the first person I visited who had an integrated site that just really brought everything together. And he had very few resources available to him and yet was able to turn an eroding 6-acre land holding into this abundant oasis. And he became an inspiration for the whole region and has inspired a great many people. The great thing about his system, which I find hard to find in the U.S. Or the seemingly more affluent world, is he was forced to make the most of what he already had freely at hand. And he did not have the luxury of purchasing and importing resources. So as a result, he was forced to be far more creative than most.
Right.
And he became my inspiration because I realized, okay, I need to place myself within similar constraints. I'm going to have to self-impose them. So for example, I said, all right, I'm not going to allow myself to use municipal water to irrigate my landscapes. I've got to do it on rainwater alone. I'm not going to allow myself any water but rainwater within my home. And by forcing myself to do that, I learned far more than I ever would have had this just been an accessory or, you know, like a plaything.
Yes.
And I, similarly to him, I said, okay, I'm not going to allow myself any pumps. I have to use gravity to move the water, or I can carry it, but gravity is a lot easier. So it it required me to put a lot more thought into everything initially. So it might have taken time to build things out as I was learning and figuring things out. But now once done, everything is so much easier and simpler. There aren't things that break down. There's no power requirements. Everything works if I'm home or not, because I've got it all working with these passive nature-inspired systems. So yeah, he was phenomenal that way. And I got to go back and visit him over 20 years later.
I was going to ask you that. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I was really lucky that I was able to go back. And to be honest, I was pretty fearful before I left because I thought, you know, that was over 20 years ago. I know a lot more now than I did then. I'm familiar with a lot more. My eyes see more. And maybe it wasn't as good as I remembered. You know, maybe I was just, he's a great storyteller. Maybe
right,
I was just like enamored with his story and he was blinding me to the truth. But when I got there, all those fears evaporated because it was so much better than I remembered it. And that was obviously for multiple reasons. One being he and his family had continued to evolve their systems in those 20 plus years. As we all know, evolve or die is the natural way. So, when I first visited him, he was, through all his planting of the rain, he was helping raise the groundwater table. Well, by the time I got there, it had raised to such a degree that he had abandoned, the hand pumps that he would occasionally use in dry season for irrigating some of his crops in the drier fields. And now the water has come up to the roots of the plants. So he doesn't have to move the water around. He doesn't have to do hand pumps. And it smelled of rotting fruit in many areas because he and his family and the neighbors couldn't keep up with production.
Oh my gosh.
So there were just mangoes everywhere, all over the ground. There were zebras. Now, it's super rare to find any of the, you know, the megafauna wildlife in the area anymore, but yet they come and they find his place and they just circle around because they want in on those mangoes. And then I got to meet a couple dozen women that were some of his latest apprentices and visit their sites. And that's what was even more exciting is the people he had taught and inspired, they're already doing incredible things just a few years in, whereas, you know, this was Mr. Peary's life. So he happily pointed out to me that they are all in short order going to jump, to leapfrog everything he was able to accomplish, because they're starting younger and they've got this platform of knowledge and understanding, learn from him and others that they can work from. So that was incredible.
Everything changes so fast too. I mean, okay, so go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh yeah, no problem. I've got all these thoughts flowing through my head about, you know, I could talk about how, you know, my brother and I have evolved things here on our property in the past 20 some years too. But I just wanted to mention the one other person that immediately came to mind who's inspired me, and that's Bill Zeedyke. So we call him the Creek Whisperer, or a fluvial rodent, just like a beaver. He's really good.
Love it.
But he is likewise mentored many people and created a whole new industry of practitioners that are striving to let the water do the bulk of the work in regenerating once degraded landscapes by just creating very simple hand-built structures with local on-site materials that nudge water and sediment in a more regenerative manner rather than an erosive manner. And it's so accessible in terms of doing the work. It's just initially it's a little bit of an uphill climb because he's asking us to really see and learn patterns on the ground and to see how water and sediment naturally flow and then to create structures that mimic natural forms that help lift that water and sediment flow to a greater potential. And I don't know how clear this is coming across just verbally, but he is, let me just give an example of one site. So the Hubble Trading Post on the Arizona-New Mexico border, where he kind of proved the efficiency and the effectiveness of his work. So there, there was an eroded creek that had become artificially straightened due to years of erosion, and it had downcut. And so the wetland had dried up because the water channel had eroded down to such a degree that the roots of the wetland could no longer tap the water. The groundwater table had dropped very significantly. And cottonwood trees had died out. The perennial flow of water was long gone. So Bill used these simple one rock high dams and these simple little baffle structures that encourage the water to meander again. And by doing so, he and the volunteers he worked with, they're able to raise this dugout bed by many feet, and they didn't have to move any soil. The water did it. They raised the water table 11 feet. They brought back the wetland. They brought back the cottonwood. They brought back the willows. And they now have perennial pools of water. And what was great is nothing was purchased. It's just using what was already on site.
It just blows my mind. It does. I mean, no, it just blows my mind. And that is that fair to say it's biomimicry? Because that's what I think of as biomimicry. Look what's happening on the earth and then mimic it because nature's got it. Yeah. They've got it. Like they've got it. Also, you know, just in your story, and I have found as Mrs. Green's world has evolved and how now we have Impact Earth and all of that, people love stories. So to your comment, how we're following it, I'm listening and it's a great story. So yeah, I'm really following it. So I think you're doing great. There's my feedback. The other thing is you talked about literally the some of the show notes you sent, they could be in an op-ed or a story in a news, you know, in a magazine about, you know, when you talk about like a healthy bank account, we need to invest or deposit more into our account than we extract or withdraw. And then you say, this all starts with the planting of the rain. Well, who says that? Brad Lancaster, that's who, was taught to me by the Zimbabwean farmer and water harvester. I'm not going to say it. Is it Zephaniah Fury Maseko? Okay. But I mean, though there's beautiful storytelling in this, and I appreciate that. So that was the first edition, okay? And then you did, was the next, then did you go right to volume two? And what was that all about?
Yeah, so originally when I wrote these water harvesting books, they were initially one massive brick of a book. And thankfully, when I
a little
started
daunting.
All this, thankfully my editor, she said, I will not work on this project unless you divide this into three books. And
wow,
she was so right. So that's what I did. Making everything, you know, a lot more digestible. And as you go into the from volume one to volume two, that's for the people that want to go deeper. Volume two, I went right into that after finishing the first edition of volume one. And that is just a lot more detailed information, step by step, how you implement all these myriad passive water harvesting earthworks or rain garden strategies, along with a whole chapter dedicated to gray water harvesting and how you can change policy, how you can take what some people might call illegal practices, but I think they're really just pre-legal. They just haven't been legalized yet because people aren't aware of their potential and efficiency, effectiveness. So such as cutting street curbs to allow street runoff to irrigate street side planting so that the street becomes the free irrigation source of the vegetation and trees growing along that street, then grow to shade, cool the street, feed those along the street, and reduce flooding from the street. So that was one strategy. Another is gray water harvesting. So when I first started writing the book, gray water harvesting was illegal in many places, but has since been legalized. And not just legalized, but as with the street runoff harvesting, it's been incentivized with rebate programs and mandated in new construction. And a lot of that has happened because of individuals like ourselves and many others that have created these pre-legal pilot projects that have proven how effective these things can be. Because in order to make something that's illegal legal, you have to do it when it's illegal so that you can show what works and what doesn't, and then that can evolve the whole policy. So I share a lot of information on case studies on such policy change and how people could do likewise.
And you went all over the place. I mean, I want to know, like, I'm like you, I'm sitting here thinking, I have to ask him this. So you did volume two, which was the deeper cut. And I was cracking up because didn't you get in a lot of trouble when you first started with the sidewalks in Tucson doing what you did? It was like, talk about trailblazer, disruptor for good. And now you're the sought after expert, not just here, but many places around the world. So you might have to break a little few rules to get change, much needed change happening, especially in these challenging times, which is all I'm going to say about that. Okay, so first edition, then second edition, and then what?
Yeah, so then every time I do a reprint of volume one or two, I would revise it because I was continually learning new things. And then I came out with a second edition of volume one, and there I realized, you know, what's really missing in the water harvesting world is the integration of other harvests. So I integrated the harvest of sun, wind, and shade along with that of water.
Okay.
And the reason I did that is because very often I would find people were doing a great job of harvesting the water, but they seem to be completely ignorant of the seasonally changing sun path. So for example, they might create a rain garden with a tree that is just thriving on nothing but free on-site waters for irrigation. But they accidentally plant on the south side of their house. So that tree cools them really well in summer. That's great. But in winter, that same tree totally shades out their access to the winter sun that would be coming from the low sky in the south. So their house becomes much colder than it was before in the winter months. So their cooling bills might go down, but their heating bills go up. And I wanted to show people how they could easily place vegetation strategically, and also water harvesting tanks and other strategies strategically, so they would both shade and cool them in summer and let in the free light and heat of the winter sun. So they would reduce summer cooling bills and reduce winter heating bills. So it's that kind of thing I wanted to incorporate. And how could you also place the vegetation in your landscape, in your tanks, in such a way that you could also harvest wind for free cooling when you wanted cooling, or deflect cold winter winds for free heating? So it's all these kind of things I wanted to bring in. And also, how could you work with human flow? So how could you make community food forests more walkable with footpaths that would need less maintenance over time? Because you could strategically place your plants so that they would need less pruning in the long term and would grow to shade over more pathway surfaces and roadway surfaces to more freely cool our communities in the summer months. All those kind of things, and more case studies as I learn from more people. Because as you were mentioning, crazy thing for me is I never thought this would be the case when I started, but really I got all these invitations to travel the world and share my learning and learn from others, and it became this wonderful cross-pollinization travels. But what enabled me to travel, my ticket to travel, was doing conscious shovel work in my own backyard. And just learning from, wow, if I'm really thinking about the change in topography I'm making so that it's making the most of free plants rather than draining them away, and doing so in a way that also collects free leaf drop and organic matter. So I'm simultaneously improving the fertility of my soil and not having to import or buy anything. And by doing it, you know, predominantly doing these passive earthworks, the shovel work, it's accessible to anyone that's willing to work a shovel. So it's very inexpensive. And that way I can teach in areas that are very monetarily rich and also those that are monetarily poor. It works in all contexts. So all that's been great. And I never would have expected this when I started. And it's been a real delight.
But the book really opens doors. I mean, it does. When you write a book and you've sold, like, people don't understand how hard it is to sell 1,000 copies of a book. You know, when people tell me they're going to write a book and that's going to be, you know, a ticket for them, I just look at them and I say, I wish you all the best. That's great. And then I think if you really want to get it out there, depending upon the content, of course, but you have sold over 50,000 copies. At least that's the last information I have. That's a big number in the book world. It's humongous. So there's an interest. And I was also thinking about it, really reflecting on what has happened, not just in my life and my expertise and my experience, but what has happened with the planet since you were on my show 10 years ago. And it's mostly not good news, except for when you talk to people like you and we highlight there have been advances. There are more people who care. There are people saving water. We have a 1 million, plant a million trees in Tucson initiative with Tucson Clean and Beautiful. So when you're living the life I do, I have to look for those good things, those hopeful things, and this is all about it. So the books, this is the third edition, third revised edition, color and all that. Why do people want to get this book too, even if they have the first edition? Like, go out and get this. Come on. Buy your new copy.
Well, it's a lot more enticing and alluring with all the color photos and color illustrations, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But also, I spent just endless hours, days, weeks, months, working with my illustrators to refine the illustrations. Because if folks are like me and they really study the visuals, that it's key that we keep updating those visuals and present more information, more accurate information. So 75% of the imagery I redid. And the person just flipping through may not be able to see that at first. But if people really study, they'll see, wow, there's different details in the new editions compared to the old editions. Also, what I did is the new second edition of Volume 2, I threw out some chapters in entirety because there are some strategies I can no longer stand behind as I've learned more effective, easier to build structures and less expensive structures and strategies. So I've removed the less effective things and replaced it with far more effective strategies that let the natural systems do more of the work for us.
And there's good, fun stories in them too. And I love it. Like I'm telling you, everywhere you go now, it's storytelling, storytelling. So I was reading things like, you know, planting junk mail to hydrate the soil and revegetate the land. These are stories that people like me, I salivate over them because, like, okay, that's one more thing can do. Bringing back grasslands with hooves of intensely herded animals and the fertility of their dung and urine. It's a thing. It's like, people, this is really a thing. And mitigating climate change with more life. I love how you put that because we are, to me, it's the clear and present danger to all of our lives, but there are ways to adapt and there are ways to mitigate. And this is, to me, more climate mitigation, especially when you talk about the marginalized communities. When you look at the maps that Katie Gannon has from Tucson Clean and Beautiful, you just realize we're still in the Great Divide in Tucson. Oh, look, Gina, here's north of Broadway. Green, 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 park, 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 park. Here's south of 22nd. Even the schools, brown, 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 brown. But I think it's exciting because Tucson is really actively engaged in a strategy to change that. And that gets me excited. So the other thing is, it sounds like these are things that are not hard for the amateur. It's not a lot of highly elevated technical, scientific. People can do a lot of what you're recommending in your two books. Is that an exaggeration or is that close to the truth?
Oh, no, that's absolutely true. All of this stuff is very easy to do, and it costs far less than the conventional way of doing things, and is effective for far longer. But there is a challenge. There is a difficulty. It's a very surmountable difficulty. But the thing that can be a little difficult is what I'm advocating is a 180-degree shift from how we conventionally do things. And so as a result, we need to retrain ourselves. We need to think in new ways. We need to see in new ways. So that initial shift to seeing in a different way and thinking in a different way, that's where the difficulty can be. But once you've made that shift, then it's much easier. So you know what I'm advocating goes against most of what we're taught and most of what is marketed to us. Because what I'm promoting and teaching does not require you to buy a lot of things. You're instead using what's freely available on hand. And so there's a lot of entities that would rather you just keep buying their product rather than empower yourself through greater understanding.
I am so glad you said that. I am so glad you said that because I've become, I think, the person you don't want at your parties sometime. And my girlfriends tease me about it because once you know, you can't unknow. That's how I feel. You can't go to a party and see 250 people eat on, I love this now, they call it upscale plastic. You know, to me, wow, upscale plastic because it's made from recyclable materials or because it's compostable, which you know it doesn't matter if it's compostable if it isn't composted correctly, which for the most part it isn't. They're going to work hard again on getting the city, you know, composting back with the compost cats. But it's like people think composting is another easy journey, and it isn't. I mean, composting takes work too. It's a change of habit. But what I want to encourage people to do, and I want to see if you have any final comments, if there's anything I didn't cover, is this is really important for me, and it's all part of the whole green enchilada. Don't order his books on Amazon. I know I'm not alone, but order his books, Brad's books, from harvestingrainwater.com. You'll get a discount. You're not supporting a deep, deep discount. You're, you know, to me, Amazon and all of the waste and the recycling that, you know, it just goes on. Don't get me going on Amazon. And Jeff Bezos is not the most philanthropic person in the world, where the Gates at least are doing stuff. Bill and Melinda Gates are doing things all over the world with their hundreds of millions of dollars. So anything we can do in my dream state, my mind-altered state, that we can make an impact on Amazon, it's not being negative. It's being so proactive to support local economies and to support, to me, the right way to do things. So I hope people will get it from harvestingrainwater.com and save money, support your work in a much more sustainable way. So I made that pitch for you, my friend. It's like, please don't.
No, I super appreciate
don't,
that.
Please don't. So is there anything?
The middle mixer.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, I am that card-carrying person, and I definitely have the fever. And I do want to tell one story before we get off the air, and you can have another story or two if you want, because I'm not in a hurry. But I want to tell the Brad Lancaster story as experienced by Gina Murphy Darling about 10 years ago. Can we do that?
Yeah.
So you're on the air. I am a neophyte. Like, I have amateur, I am like a sponge, an excited sponge. It's not a put down. I'm on this journey. I'm going to interview Brad Lancaster. I know what you do. So it was hot. We were on News Talk 790, KNST. On the weekend, and I said, I think I had, you know, maybe 600 listeners at the time. So off air, I said, you said you were leaving for Australia for a month. And I said, well, I saw you, I was really puzzled because I saw you ride your bike to the studio and we brought it inside. And I said, well, how are you getting there? You know, I was really naive. You said, I'm riding my bike. And I said, to the airport? And you said, uh-huh. And I said, well, where do you put it? And you said, there are storage areas and they, you know, there's a place that you can park it. And I said, well, what about your luggage? I wouldn't ask you those questions anymore, okay? And you said, this is my luggage. And I was looked at it. I mean, it's like a not even a big backpack. And I said, because I was another person, and I said, what about your shoes? Like, I couldn't even fit all my shoes for a month in Australia. And you said, well, I'm wearing a pair and there's an extra pair in there. And it was, I think, maybe 109, something like that. And the airport was, what, 15 miles easily?
Yeah.
I'm just going to say. So you got on my hero list immediately. You just moved right over into the hero column. And I said to you at that time, and I stand by it, I will never do that. It's like, I've evolved. I'm still not taking my bicycle to the airport when it's 109, but I'm grateful for people like you that so walk this walk in every integrated way that you can think of. And my personal journey has certainly been an interesting one just for, you know, I walk in a lot of worlds, and for some of the charity events I go to, I'm so proud when I get a secondhand dress at Goodwill or at Buffalo Exchange and proudly tell people, this is, oh my, I got this for $57 at Buffalo Exchange. So that's an evolution for me, big time. So do you have any, do you have a final story other than buy the book, buy the books, buy the books?
Well, I do have a key water piece I want to say, but just before I do that, just want to offer a little encouragement to folks on the bicycle journey. So I've been car-free since 1996.
Oh my God.
And then when I turned 50, I bought myself an electrical assist motor that I attached to my bike. So now my bicycle, it's also my electrical vehicle. But the great thing is it spends the bulk of the energy moving me, not the vehicle, because I weigh more than the bicycle as opposed to
the
electric car. It's made my radius, bikeable radius, even wider. It's just been a joy because I found as I got older, my bicycling radius was slowly shrinking. Well, now it's dramatically expanded.
I get it. Oh my God, I love how you put that too. My radius, that's very good. My radius is the loop because I'm a scaredy cat and I took a bad fall once and I don't go on the road. Thank goodness for the loop because it's one of the most beautiful ways that you can spend time in our city. So, my friend, it's just so amazing to me to look at the progress. And I need to see those things in my world these days of now there we have whole organizations in Tucson leading the way to do it. We have you, we have your brother, we have the books. There's a lot going on, you know, watershed management. Look at what they're doing. And there's so many great positive things that just don't make the news. And that's what I wish would happen. They made this news. They made Mrs. Green's World, and we're going to shout it from the rooftop. So thank you. And, you know, I usually get the last word. So what else? Did you want to add another thing about water, you said?
Yeah, I just wanted to add one other thing is that, you know, so often we tend to try and just solve problems rather than trying to lift the potential of things. And so while a lot of what I do is water conservation, I actually look at it differently. I don't see it as water conservation, because water conservation, that's just minimizing a negative. It's minimizing an overconsumption of water. So I want to instead maximize the positive. So, you know, just looking at that statistic I gave earlier, that more rain falls on Tucson in an average year of rain than all of the population of Tucson consumes of municipal water in a year, what I'd like to pose as a challenge to everyone is, how can we as individuals, and how can we as a community, how can we as a watershed, and how can we as a state and a country give back more water to all our local rivers, be it the Santa Cruz River, the Colorado River, what have you, give back more water to them than we take out, give back more to the natural systems that sustain us than we extract from them. And if we do that, life is just going to get better and better for all generations, and those that have not yet been born included. So that's what I'm striving for in my work. And by striving for that, it's a very high aim. I can't get lazy. So things are going really good here. I mean, we're putting far more water into the soils of our landscape than we take out through our living pumps and so on. But I'm pushing to see, well, how can I refine that even more? How can I show people how they can do so likewise or even better, and in an even less expensive way, and an even more effective way, so that this can catch fire, go viral in a good way, and more people will do this? And how can we change policy, not just practice, to go even further? Because it's all very doable. When I was doing my research for my second book, I found that 5 dying rivers had been revived in India because the people, the villages, folks throughout the watersheds had changed their practices to do exactly what I'm challenging people to do, which is to give back more than they take from the natural system. So they revegetated their watershed. They revived their rivers. The rivers are flowing more strongly now than they ever were before. And we can do the exact same thing. And so I lay out tons of information and enticing strategies, effective strategies that people can use, and invite them to do so. And tied into that too, with all these great tree planting programs in Tucson and elsewhere, I think it's essential that we shift on how we plant trees. Because all too often, we plant a tree in some other place, some other climate, you know, an exotic tree, using water imported from somewhere else, such as pumped in from the Colorado River to irrigate that tree, and synthetic fertilizers to fertilize it. So if we want a real easy way to succeed with tree planting, we have to first plant the rain before we plant the tree. And we have to plant the tree within or beside a water harvesting earthwork that is going to capture, infiltrate, and reinvest more free rainfall and runoff than that tree and its associated vegetation will consume in a year. So we will be giving back more than we take. And that same earthwork or rain garden will also be capturing leaf drop and whatnot, the nutrients, the free nutrients, bird droppings, to provide free fertilizer. And by using native food-bearing trees, we're selecting trees, vegetation of here, directly connected to the rich culinary and cultural history of this area, while also providing superior wildlife habitat. Quick little statistic. A native mesquite tree in Tucson, planted in Tucson, attracts over 60 native pollinators. But a non-native mesquite tree planted in Tucson only supports 12. So just by selecting the right tree, we can dramatically enhance the wildlife habitat potential, the free pollination, not only of that tree, but of our gardens. We become, our sense of place has exploded to not only be right here in Tucson, but the migratory bird routes of the birds, the neotropical songbirds that are coming from Central America to Alaska and Canada and back twice a year, such as the Wilson's warbler. It's this beautiful small bird that has to refuel on its migratory journey. And it can drop into one native mesquite tree And in just 2 to 4 days, hanging out in that one native mesquite tree, they can increase its body weight by 10 to 20%, just feasting on the insects in that one tree. But if it drops into a non-native mesquite, it's screwed because it's not going to get anywhere near the bounty. So there's all these just simple decisions, choices we can make, ways we can tap into and collaborate with the natural system, which I lay out in depth in the books and on my website and harvestingrainwater.com and much more. And I just invite folks to tune in, tap in, and partner with.
And get involved. It's so what you are supporting and shouting out about and are so passionate about, it's so doable. And with the blessing of Trees for Tucson, the trees are affordable. Like one of my sponsors is Chapman. Chapman buys trees. They've bought 3,000 or 4,000 trees because they offered in some of their dealerships, you can either get this keychain or we'll plant a tree or we'll have it, you know, taken to your home. You know, get your companies. It's just so inspiring when you think I can make a difference and it's not going to cost me $500. It might be a shovel, an investment of a shovel. So that's what, to me, there's so many things inspiring about your message, but it's the just do one thing. And I think we could plant 1 million trees in Tucson in a year. And that's the challenge I keep talking to Katie Gannon about. Forget 2030. We could do it in a year if we mobilize this community. So anyway, I keep talking that up. So I do want
to... Here's one other thing I'll add to that.
Yeah.
So if we're going to plant 1 million trees, we have to plant 4,500 times in terms of stormwater. So we're harvesting 4 trillion gallons of stormwater a year. I might have done the math wrong because I was just doing that in my head. But
and I'm not fact-checking.
Yeah. So we plant the rain first before we plant the trees, because I like to create the average street-side water harvesting basin. I like it to be about 5 feet wide, 8 feet long, and a foot deep. So it's got a 4,500-gallon annual capacity. Just on the surface, if I include what it captures and infiltrates below, it's well over 10,000 gallons a year. So I can support not just that tree, but this rich forest of understory plants, of vines, of tubers, of cacti, of bushes and shrubs. So it becomes far more diverse and abundant. And once established, only irrigated with once perceived wastewaters that are now free on-site resource waters.
You know, what else can I say? Like, seriously. And what I started with in the show is that water is our most precious resource. We cannot live without it. That's the deal. It's like, bam, that's it. We can't live without it. And I unfortunately think that a lot of the recent tragedies, like half of Australia burning to the ground and 1 billion animals dead, which I'm going to start crying and I don't want to do that. And the wildfires in the West and the flooding in the Midwest, it's waking people up. I hope it's quick enough and fast enough. And then don't just wake up. Ask yourself, what am I going to do about it? What can I do in my yard or in my apartment complex or at my office to get engaged? Because that's it. We need every man, woman, and child pulling in the same direction, because the planet will survive. The planet will survive. It will right itself. But we want to leave. I want my grandchildren to be around long after I'm gone. So I just want to end by thanking you so much for putting the spotlight on the world's most precious resource and how to preserve every drop we can. And to just let you know very personally that from the first interview, you left a footprint on my heart, and I've watched what you've done and you've made a big difference for the planet. And I feel like it's been an honor to spend this time with you.
Oh.
So keep on doing what you're doing.
We'll do, and you as well. I mean, I super appreciate the opportunity to share it all and to help you generate positive, empowering media, which I think we need more of.
Oh my gosh, I'm with you. I'm with you from your mouth to the universal flow.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Brad, and keep up all you're doing. You're right, we can't get tired. We just have to keep going.
That's right. Keep it juicy.
Yes.